A new trade deal with China. What's in it for us? Could be a sizable portion of Chinese spending on sectors with a strong Texas showing. A closer look today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. It's not the end of the trade war, but a new trade agreement with China might make a difference to industries in the Lone Star State. Also, what sounds like a change of position on climate change from the head of the Texas Oil and Gas Association. Is it? And Trader Joe's still the best grocery chain in America? Here's a hint. No, it's not. What is and why, plus a whole lot more, when the national news show of You Know Where gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Thursday, the 16th day of January. Happy birthday wishes to Barbara Lynn, the Beaumont-born guitar slinger and songwriter who took a painful breakup and turned it into one of the coolest songs of the 1960s. You'll lose a good thing. In case you missed it, the reigning Empress of Gulf Coast Soul was named a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment for the Arts in 2018, and she's still rocking that Stratocaster today. A good thing indeed. We hope her 78th birthday is a happy one. Glad tidings for Texas in this new trade deal with China. Well, you may have heard a bit about this one. TV station in Waco, Channel 25, reporting that Texas farmers hard hit by the president's trade war with China, now cheering upon word that President Trump and Chinese leaders have signed an agreement designated as Phase 1. Not ending the trade war altogether, but an important starting point, as they're characterizing it. The new deal calls for China to spend $40 to $50 billion on U.S. agriculture, $75 billion on manufacturing, $50 billion on energy, and $40 billion on financial services, all of which Texas has serious stakes in. This is far from the apocalyptic outcome once predicted by so many economists, but it's also far from the final outcome of a deep-seated dispute. Raymond Robertson is director of the Mosbacher Institute for Trade, Economics, and Public Policy at Texas A&M. Professor Roberts, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this is just phase one, as I understand it. But what does yesterday's deal actually do? What are the significant changes that weren't in place back in 2017 when President Trump decided to alter his direction when it came to trade in China?
Well, some of the main advances have been some protections for intellectual property. That was a big deal with Trump's complaints against China, saying that China had been stealing intellectual property and not protecting a lot of U.S. innovation. And so now there's provisions in this agreement that China will crack down on that. And also, China has agreed to reduce or even eliminate transfer of technology from American companies that operated in China. That was a precondition for their operating in China. So that should also go away. Those are the two big gains.
The element that seems to be picked up by a lot of the media is that China has agreed to purchase an additional $200 billion worth of U.S. goods over the next 2 years. Maybe that's been picked up upon because it's an easy to understand concept here. But I'm curious, what kind of dent will that make as you see it?
Well, that's actually a great point, and I agree that a lot of people are focusing on that. I wouldn't focus on that as much because the promises of Chinese purchases are so much larger than their actual purchases had been before the trade war. If you look at energy, for example, they've committed to buying $52 billion more in energy, but in 2017-2018, they only actually bought $8 billion. So it would be an increase of almost seven times more than they've ever purchased in the past. And so there's a lot of question of whether or not the Chinese economy can actually absorb that much of an increase in imports.
Is this a win for President Trump's strategy?
Well, obviously, you could look at it in a number of different ways. The actual tariff reductions are only going down from, you know, there are very small reductions. I mean, some of the tariffs in place are going to remain in place. The reductions are going from 21% down to 19.3%. So the actual tariff reductions from this agreement are not that large. And some of the research that's come out from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, for example, showed that the United States consumers are paying 100% of those tariffs. Mm-hmm. The tariffs are not imposing costs on China. So the costs to the American economy have been very, very large so far, and the new agreement doesn't reduce those tariffs very much.
So Americans are absorbing those tariffs. What kind of impact is that having, though, on the U.S. economy?
Well, one of the things that this research has found is that the prices that we pay at the grocery store, at the department store, at other places have been going up. So there's been a big increase in just consumer prices. Then the other big change has been a change in the way global production is structured. So we used to, and still do, but have a lot of what's called the global value chain link with China, where China produces parts for U.S. products, mm-hmm. and then they assemble other parts that we make. And so there's exchange of parts, and manufacturers have had to restructure their production as a result of these tariffs, which has led to a lot of disruption and potentially lower employment in those manufacturing sectors. It doesn't show up right now because the economy is doing great. We haven't seen kind of these incredible macroeconomic conditions for quite some time, in over 10 years. So the economy overall is doing great, but the trade agreement itself has not been helping the employment in that direction.
This is just phase one, as they say. What can you expect? What do you expect from the next phases of this trade deal as it moves forward?
Well, you know, we're always really optimistic that they're going to continue to try and resolve these and bring the tariffs back down to the pre-dispute levels, which were actually 3%. I mean, now they're, you know, 19.3%, and they were 3% before. We're hoping that we can get to an agreement that will bring us back down to those low tariffs. But at the same time, the conditions of the agreement are that if China doesn't meet those purchase targets in terms of increasing their imports that you mentioned earlier, there's going to be more tariffs being put into place. So it could go either way, but we'd like to be optimistic that this is a positive step and that we're going to make continued progress on reducing those tariffs and opening these markets.
Raven Robertson is professor and chair in economics and government at the Department of International Affairs at the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M. He's also director of the Mosbacher Institute for Trade Economics and Public Policy there. Professor, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
For decades, voters in Katy and Sugarland preferred Republicans when they picked their member of Congress, often by a 2-to-1 margin, by the way. Then 2 years back, Republican Pete Olson won, but by only 5 percentage points. Now Olson is retiring and Democrats think they can pick up this seat. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider looks at whether Texas 22 could be a bellwether.
The 22nd Congressional District stretches from Webster in southeast Harris County across northern Brazoria County. But the heart of the district is Fort Bend County, accounting for 70% of the vote. And for the last two election cycles, Fort Bend County has been trending Democratic. Craig Goodman teaches political science at the University of Houston, Victoria.
You know, I think this is one of those districts that is really kind of a carbon copy maybe of what we've seen in other suburban districts around the state. And around the country, that districts that are more diverse are becoming more open to Democratic candidates.
Five Democrats are vying for the chance to flip the district. Leading the pack is Sri Preston Kulkarni, a former diplomat who ran but lost against Olson in 2018.
Fort Bend County is the second most diverse county in the entire country, and we had to go to a lot of communities where nobody had really talked to them. So, for example, in the Asian community, 72% of them had never been talked to by a Republican or a Democrat.
Kulkarni is fluent in Hindi and Mandarin Chinese, as well as Spanish, which gives him an advantage in reaching out to the district's large immigrant population. He's also got a big fundraising lead over his Democratic rivals. As for his top issue, it's personal.
We go to community after community where their number one issue is health care. Everybody, you know, no matter what your background is, somebody has a story just like mine, my family's story, where my dad got cancer when I was 18, and when he died when I was 19, we were on the point of bankruptcy.
Aside from healthcare, Kulkarni is focused on flood control and gun control. The latter could be a difficult sell in a district that's long been a Republican stronghold, but he's convinced that momentum is on his side.
It was our effort. It was actually the effort of grassroots volunteers which pushed Pete Olson into dropping out of the race.
Not everyone agrees Kulkarni's 2018 showing makes him the best Democratic standard bearer this time.
I believe, unfortunately, in the last cycle, the Democrats had a very strong chance of winning. But the ball was dropped.
Nyanza Moore is an attorney and one of Kulkarni's opponents. Moore is also heavily focused on health care. She recently lost both her sister and her father, and she's furious at Republican efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. but she feels Kulkarni lost in part because he didn't spend enough time in Brazoria County, which is majority-minority, like Fort Bend County, but more Republican.
I never got a knock on my door, not one time, from anybody in the Democratic Party on that side. And I live in Pearland. I never got a sign in my yard. No one ever called me. And if you're not touching the people in my area, then you're not going to win.
Derek Reed is a former Pearland City Council member and another of Kulkarni's Democratic rivals. He, too, sees health care as the pivotal issue for the district.
The one thing that I've continuously heard from every person that I've spoken with, the main concern is health care. That's the main thing from a business owner's perspective, from a just a layperson's perspective. They want access to better, more affordable health care.
If there's one other thing Reed, Moore, and Kulkarni all agree on, it's that the district's diversity provides the Democrats' best chance to turn the 22nd blue this year.
This was historically the district that Tom DeLay did his best to gerrymander, you know, back in the early 2000s. The dynamics of the district have changed. The demographics of the district have changed.
All that said, GOP voters are sure to turn out in force to vote in November when the race for president tops the ballot. Most analysts view the congressional race as one of the tightest in Texas. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
Well, it's Thursday already. Let's check in with social media editor Wells Dunbar, find out what Texans are talking about.
Hi, David. We're hearing from folks about a range of things this Thursday, including that story we just aired, the 15 Republicans and 5 Democrats fighting it out for their party's nomination in Texas' 22nd congressional district outside of Houston. Redistricting expert Michael Lee, friend of the show, been on before, he tweets us that that district, to me, is one of the most fascinating congressional districts in the country, a mirror into both the America of the present and that of the future. Also hearing about another story we've been keeping an eye on, a federal judge has blocked the Trump administration order allowing state and local governments to turn away refugees from resettling. That injunction effectively nullifies Governor Greg Abbott's recent decision to bar resettlement in Texas while the matter works its way through the courts. You know, the governor's decision to bar refugee resettlement, the only state, Texas, the only state that moved to do so under these new rules, proved very controversial with our friends and listeners online. They appeared to be welcoming this new development. Just one representative reaction from our Facebook page there. Brian Jackson says, good, I approve the federal judge's block. And so this injunction apparently clearing the way for those refugee resettlement agencies, not the state that does this work primarily, but those private agencies to continue that work here in Texas.
Why do I think that this challenge is going to be challenged?
Because those challenges indeed challenged.
We'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. You need to look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He's going to be joining us again in about 35 minutes or so with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Why is getting a thorough count of the homeless so important? Well, advocates say there's a lot at stake if that doesn't happen. The annual homeless count is set to take place in several Texas cities in just a few days. And as KERA's Courtney Collins tells us, the process keeps getting a bit more advanced by the year.
Homeless counts happen across Texas and the country every year during the last week in January. That's strategic, the thought being that on a cold January night, people who have a sheltered place to sleep will be there, meaning everyone who remains on the street likely has nowhere else to go. On January 23rd, volunteers in Dallas and Collin counties will tally what's known as unsheltered homeless. And Diana Romanoli with the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance says they've got to make that count, well, count.
They're out there. So if we don't see them January 23rd, we may see them April 14th, and we still need to take care of them.
Federal funding from the Department of Housing and Urban Development is influenced by the annual homeless count, meaning if volunteers miss too many unsheltered homeless, they're leaving money on the table. That's one reason why David Gruber with the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance says they need a lot of volunteers out counting.
It is much easier to get the job done when we have about 1,500 volunteers. Once upon a time we had 500, once upon a time we had 750, then we had 1,000. We have kind of found that the sweet spot is around 1,500.
Volunteer signups have been slower than usual this year, so MDHA is looking for more people to get involved. Dallas has been doing this since before HUD required it. The first homeless count in Dallas happened back in 2003. Things have changed quite a bit since then, especially the technology. Volunteers used to carry paper and pencil and write out all the answers to homeless count questions.
There would be these long legal-sized pages, because there's like 17 questions or something. So it's like legal-sized pages, and you have to be like in the dark with a flashlight figuring that out.
When the volunteers brought that mountain of paper back at the end of the count, it would all have to be transcribed into a database, entry by entry. Starting in 2017, the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance said enough's enough and started using an app. Now data is collected and preserved in real time, which Gruber says cuts down on errors. And better still,
once everybody's done counting, we can then sort by question and we can query inside the app, okay, who's a veteran, right? Give us all the veterans.
Which helps connect people with services they may not have known they qualified for. The app also records the latitude and longitude where a homeless person was interviewed, which helps nonprofits find that person again. This year's homeless count will cover more ground than ever before, including the suburbs. Teams from Mesquite and Richardson will organize meticulous efforts in those communities, areas that didn't have many volunteers in years past. Diana Romanoli says asking questions on homeless count night, like, where are you sleeping, or are you a veteran, is just part of the process. Making a connection is equally important.
What we ask our folks that are going up for the count is to have a conversation. Don't kind of go through 17 questions, you know, just rattling them off. Develop a relationship, talk to them.
Romanoli says the vast majority of homeless in any given city or town are from that city or town.
They don't want to be invisible and they don't want to be nameless. They want to be part of our community.
Which is why she says a homeless count cannot simply be a tally of people on the street on January 23rd. It has to be a unified, impassioned effort to make sure that every person out in the cold that night is both counted and cared for. In Dallas, I'm Courtney Collins for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. President Trump is well known for scolding Silicon Valley companies and their leaders, but new plans aimed at relaxing the regulatory burden on artificial intelligence or AI technologies may likely sound more pleasing to the ears of those who are developing autonomous cars, computer-based decision-making tools, and facial recognition technologies. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to take a look at the pros and cons of the administration's AI plans. Hello there, Omar. Good to see you, sir.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
I have to confess, I didn't know there were any AI regulations. I guess there have to be something in autonomous cars, perhaps.
Yeah, this goes back a ways, back to the Obama administration. There is a kind of a list they come out with every year of sort of guidance on what they would like the policies and kind of the talking points around AI to be. And this year, it's, you know, 10 principles around things like civil liberties, things like transparency and fairness. But really, the message that they were putting out this year, that the Trump administration was putting out at the Consumer Electronics Show, which we talked about before, is, you know, we want a light touch on regulation. We don't want to overregulate these industries that are still developing, really kind of a hands-off approach to these technologies that have a lot of people kind of spooked.
Yeah, sort of a laissez-faire, which is consistent with their sort of economic philosophy to begin with. But I want to get back to the meaning of artificial intelligence, because when we last spoke, you were saying there were a lot of products out there that were claiming to be AI or AI related, and they really weren't, right? So when we're talking about artificial intelligence or products with that content, what specifically are we talking about?
I mean, they can be everything from, you know, the speech devices, the Alexas and things that we talk about. Sorry to if I set yours off just now.
Yeah, right.
But things like that. But really, we're talking also increasingly about things like facial recognition technology, which we know is being used in law enforcement and other industries. And that's become a hot issue in Europe, where there's some regulation talk about that. Things like machine learning and kind of big computing. And, you know, really it becomes a thing where anytime you're talking about privacy or security issues, AI is starting to come into the picture.
I was going to say, this sounds like sort of a proxy for privacy, really.
It is. And I think it's sort of a shield against, you know, there's been so much talk about regulating, you know, the social media companies and the privacy industry, and that they've come under fire in Congress. I think this is a, you know, hey, guys, let's take it easy on them. Let's let them do their thing and not overregulate these industries. And this is guidance not just for the U.S. lawmakers, but they're really trying to have an influence on Europe as well, where these are becoming much more heated issues.
Presumably, the idea of less regulation is that you would encourage more development, more research in the field, more experimentation, that sort of thing. What are some of the concerns about this minimalist approach?
Well, I mean, some of it, as I said, carries over from the Obama administration, and there is kind of an encouragement of like, let's get a lead on these technologies, let's be leaders in these technologies, you know, worldwide.
The concern is that we need to be in that ring, in the arena, shaping these policies.
Yeah, where it starts to fall apart, though, and some tech experts have kind of pointed this out, is that, you know, if we're trying to lead on the basis of ethics, of like, let's have ethics in AI, let's make sure this doesn't get out of hand, the Trump administration doesn't have a great track record when it comes to ethics and the tech industry. So that's where it kind of breaks down, is that they're trying to kind of lead by example and kind of have influence in Europe, but their track record on things like privacy and security are not fantastic.
You know, Europe has taken the lead in a lot of privacy and AI stuff, but I'm also thinking China's got to be a player here, or are they? I mean, are they involved in the regulatory conversation when it comes to AI?
Yeah, China is pretty much unregulated and can do whatever it wants. So I think this is sort of a compromise between, you know, let's not let our tech industry get stifled and continue to innovate and lead against countries like China. We don't want to be left behind countries like that.
But of course, China could set the standard in a sense if it wanted to.
You could argue that on things like hacking and things like that, they already have taken the lead, and Russia for that matter.
Yeah. Omar Gayaga is keeping tabs on tech over at techminutetexas.com. Good to talk with you again, Omar. We will see you, I guess, next week.
Yeah, thanks for having me, David. Appreciate it.
Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time, and I believe it's the Texas Roundup that's coming up next. We're right there at the bottom of the hour, so you're going to want to stick around for that.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Organizations in Texas say they'll be able to keep resettling refugees after a federal judge temporarily blocked an executive order allowing states and local governments to refuse to accept those fleeing their home countries. The ruling Wednesday comes less than a week after Governor Greg Abbott became the first governor in the country to say refugees would not be allowed to initially move to the state starting in June. Chris Kelly is a spokesperson for Refugee Services of Texas. He hopes now Governor Abbott will reconsider his decision.
We strongly urge Governor Abbott to listen to the overwhelming majority of Texans who welcome refugees and who wish to continue to provide safety, fresh starts, and open hearts to refugee children, mothers, and fathers in the years to come.
Prior to the judge's ruling, at least 40 other governors had informed the Trump administration they would continue resettling refugees in their states. The Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, set a new record for guns discovered at security checkpoints in 2019. As KERA's Miguel Perez reports, three Texas airports ranked in the top 10 nationwide for firearms confiscations.
217 guns were picked up last year during security screenings at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. DFW was second only to Atlanta's major airport. Coming in at fourth was George Bush Intercontinental Airport in Houston. There, the TSA found 138 guns. Dallas Love Field was also in the top 10 in the nation for gun confiscations. Overall, the TSA reports firearm discoveries at U.S. airports were up 5%. From 2018. Individuals who bring weapons to a checkpoint are subject to up to $13,000 in federal civil penalties. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
2019 was the Earth's second warmest year on record, according to new data from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And as KUT's Mose Bouchel reports, Texas is part of the trend.
Not only was last year's average temperature among the very warmest, the data show how the Earth has been getting warmer decade by decade ever since 1970. NASA Director Gavin Schmidt says it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that this decade will continue to break heat records. After that...
That depends on what we do with emissions, and we aren't able to tell you by looking at the past how society will actually react to this information.
Here in Texas, the average temperature was 1.2 degrees above average last year, making it the 17th warmest statewide since record-keeping began.
Moz Bouchel reporting. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the law firm of Barron Adler, Clough & Odo, handling eminent domain and condemnation cases throughout Texas, protecting private property rights for over 30 years. BarronAdler.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. It's estimated that over the last 10 years, about 700 migrants died crossing the desert in Brooks County alone. This is ground zero of what some have called a humanitarian crisis in South Texas, in which migrants risk death trying to get into the U.S. without legal authorization. What happens to the remains of those who don't make it? Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports on a grim but important effort at finding closure for families.
On a bright winter's day, two graves are being dug at the Sacred Heart Cemetery in Falfurrias. This is a dig to retrieve bodies of unidentified migrants who died in the Brooks County desert.
These are people that probably died on somebody's private ranch in Brooks County.
Kate Spradley is a forensic anthropologist at Texas State University and director of Operation ID, which seeks to document and identify the migrant remains that are found in South Texas and then return those remains to their families.
They're in the Texas desert walking to try to get around the checkpoint, and it's very easy to get disoriented. There's nothing to orient you north, so you can just walk around in the same mile, you know, for days, not knowing which way north is. And it, when you get dehydrated or you're injured and you get separated from your group.
Some of those human remains are discovered and end up buried here at Sacred Heart Cemetery, but buried without ceremony. It's more accurate to say that these human remains were disposed of by throwing them without much care into holes in the ground. The migrant bodies are sometimes in garbage bags, cardboard boxes, or milk crates, sometimes two, three, or four individuals to a hole.
A local informant came to us in January and told us that she could not buy the plot next to her father because there might be unidentified people buried there.
Operation ID usually works like that. There are few records of unidentified migrant burials. South Texas counties are overwhelmed and underfunded for this task. So when Spradley gets a tip that there might be some migrants buried in a spot, they go check it out. But she says the people who oversee the Sacred Heart Cemetery aren't much help.
There's been maybe 130 that have been exhumed from the cemetery. There could be 50 more, there could be 100 more just in this cemetery alone. This is the cemetery where the migrants are buried. We're in Brooks County. This is the county cemetery, so this is where they go.
This is where almost everyone in Brooks County gets buried. It's a focal point of the community. Most of the gravestones are festooned with decorations to mark the passing holidays. There's an active Facebook page for the cemetery with lots of festive graveside photos. The placement of the burial plots also tells the history of local racial segregation, and community members are a little uneasy seeing how outsiders are digging up unidentified migrants right in the middle of Sacred Heart.
Actually, I just came around to just pass by my parents and I saw all of this.
San Juanita Olivares is a Falfurrias native and was curious about the activity in the cemetery.
I'm glad they're finding these bodies. Especially the unidentified ones. They, you know, if I had a son or daughter and was missing, I'd want to know. And the fact that they're being, that after this part, they hopefully will be identified.
It's taken a full day of digging, and the team of forensic anthropology students who have been shoveling dirt, hauling it away in wheelbarrows, and then using hand spades and brushes have uncovered evidence of other possible burials at this site. But mainly, they have exposed one central migrant burial. It's an individual in a blue cremation bag.
Like away and under, yeah.
The team is going to carefully hoist the stiffened remains out of the grave and place it into a white plastic disaster body bag. And now the real work begins that might lead to matching a name to that body.
And then we'll submit a DNA sample to the federal DNA database called CODIS, the Combined DNA Index System. We'll put all of the information we have about this person into NAMIS, which is the National and Unidentified Missing Persons System. And NAMIS is nice because we upload that information. We upload photos of any personal effects, clothing, sometimes stuffed animals, luchador masks. There's all kinds of stuff that people carry with them that they're buried with.
Anyone can search the NAMIS website. Families frequently go online looking for answers about what happened to their missing loved ones.
We've identified 35 people so far, and we have a few more identifications pending. You know, it's great to make an identification, but for that family member, we have to realize that it's the first time they have to process the death. You know, it's not the outcome that they had hoped for. But they get answers to questions, and I think that helps them quite a bit. They don't have to not know anymore.
The Brooks County Sheriff's Department says that for every body of an unidentified migrant that is recovered, there are at least five more out in the desert that were never recovered. Their remains were set upon by the environments and the elements, and they basically became part of the landscape, which is why many people look at South Texas and say the whole area is now one big graveyard. In Brooks County, David Martin Davies reporting.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Marika Flatt, travel editor with Texas Lifestyle Magazine, here with your weekend trip tip. The Texas Gulf Coast town of Port Aransas is set along 18 miles of beachfront on Mustang Island. Port A, as it is affectionately called, continues to gain popularity with visitors from both Texas and across the U.S. The city credits those increased numbers to events, festivals, and more lodging available. Probably the most upscale lodging option in Port Aransas is Cinnamon Shore. It's a master-planned community full of pastel-colored beach houses and condos, where most people are riding cruisers or golf carts, and the pace is relaxed. High season is definitely the summer months, but rentals are available year-round, and accommodations range from three-story homes to single-story condos with full kitchens and washer and dryer. With beach access, pools, and even restaurants, this is a self-contained vacation destination. And another option is Sunflower Beach Resort and Residences. It's nestled among 50 acres of protected dune preserves. The planned mix of custom-built homes, luxury beach cabins, family villas, and modern condos are complemented by a central beach club with separate adult and family pools, direct beach access, and just a short walk to downtown Port A. Port Aransas has long been recognized as a top deep sea fishing destination for its proximity to deep water on the edge of the continental shelf, while offering outstanding bay fishing in the waterways surrounding Mustang Island. Home to hundreds of permanent migrating birds, Mustang Island features six sites along the Great Texas Coastal Birding Trail. And visitors can also swim, surf, fish, hike, bike, and kayak at Mustang Island State Park, or see stunning views of the island's massive wetlands at the Port Aransas Wetland Park. That's your weekend trip tip. I'm Marika Flatt for the Texas Standard.
Marika Flatt is travel editor for Texas Lifestyle Magazine. You can find more of her weekend trip tips at texasstandard.org. Let's have a conversation about brand loyalty, shall we? Earlier this month, consumer data company dunnhumby released a ranking of U.S. grocery stores. The data came from thousands of customers asked about how satisfied they were with their local grocer. Dozens of stores were included in the survey, some of the really big names, but there was only one winner, toppling Trader Joe's in the number one spot, three letters, H-E-B. A company that's become a Texas retail icon. What is it about HEB that makes it, as our next guest so deftly put it once upon a time, the cultiest cult grocer in America? Joining us to discuss is Priya Krishna. She is a food writer who contributes to Bon Appetit and the New York Times, and she's a Texan, I understand. Priya, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
We gather here not to praise HEB, but to understand what is going on. Now, I understand that you did a piece about a year ago for Eater in which you described what separates HEB from other regional grocers. Can you sum that up for us?
Yeah, I think what I realized when, you know, I spent a day at the corporate headquarters and started talking to people was that HEB understands how loyal Texans are to Texas. You know, they understand the multiculturalness of Texas. They understand that Texans feel a real sense of pride and that their identity is linked to being from Texas. You know, it's why their best-selling items are Texas-shaped tortilla chips and right. that they sell, you know, 20 different kinds of queso, and that, you know, in certain HEBs, there's no ethnic aisle because, you know, something like a tortilla is just a standard offering because in Texas, everyone eats tortillas. Mm-hmm. And I found that keen understanding of what it means to be a Texan so compelling, and the reason why they've been able to find such success.
You know, there are a lot of big chains here in Texas. There's a Kroger, especially up north. Randall's is big here in Texas. Some of these chains, other grocers, have been Texas-based, but they don't seem to lean in as much on the Texas side of things. How do you think HEB's managed to tap into Texas pride and identity without coming across as sort of ham-fisted or overdoing the Texas tropes? I mean, it would be a little odd if Randall started slapping, you know, stars all over the front or something along those lines, right?
I mean, it was built into their brand identity from the very start. Mm. I mean, they have a whole section where you can get handmade tortillas. They have a in-house barbecue restaurant. Their gas stations serve breakfast tacos. It's not just that they sell Texas-shaped waffle irons, which they do. It's that Texas permeates every aspect of what they do.
You know, these days we often see businesses try to take a position on social issues, and they do that quite often to protect a particular part of the market. That's not something we've really seen that much from HEB. They've sort of managed to remain, what, all things to all Texans, I suppose. But how do you think they've done that?
It's really interesting. I mean, this is something that I sometimes do wish that they would take a stronger stance, because their brand really is built upon the strength of Texas's immigrant communities, and namely its Hispanic communities. And it's always funny to me that, you know, Texans are so able, so many people, not just Texans, are able to sort of divorce politics from food. You can hate immigration, but love tacos. And it's a little bit, it sometimes concerns me the way that HEB is able to give you the tacos without the politics. That part of it has always puzzled me.
Well, now I have to ask you, because I understand you're in the Big Apple these days. Is there anything mm-hmm. you miss about HEB personally?
I miss the tortillas, and I miss the fact that you can walk up and get a flour tortilla fresh to snack on while you walk the aisles. I miss Hatch Chili season, like all the Hatch Chili products that they sell, like the Hatch Chili cookies, the Hatch Chili beer. I miss that. I also just miss the service. You know, at HEB, if you can't find something, someone will literally walk you directly to the place where the item is. They won't just sort of like gesture in a corner. It's just, it really is like emblematic of Texas hospitality. I grew up in Dallas, where infamously there's no HEB, but we had a Central Market. Uh-huh. And we loved the Central Market. That's where I tried scones for the first time, Kalamata olives for the first time.
Right.
It sort of opened me up to sort of a world of global flavors when I was living in a Dallas suburb with not a lot of non-chain restaurant options at the time.
Yeah, see, I thought you were going to say what you missed was striking up a conversation with some random person in the ice cream aisle, because that seems to happen quite a lot at an HEB. You just people will just talk.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, it sort of goes on to this like Texas hospitality thing. You know, in New York, people aren't making eye contact. In Texas, people are constantly wanting to strike up conversations.
Priya Krishna is a contributor to Bon Appetit and the New York Times, and we love having conversations with her. Her cookbook, Indian-ish, is available wherever you find books. Priya, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Sure, thank you.
See, the thing is, I don't remember people going gaga over Giant back, in Washington, D.C., or Vons out in Southern California. I mean, anybody? What do you think of HEB? Too much made of it, or you think it's really deserves these accolades? Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard Wells, back in just a couple.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As you may have heard in the Texas Roundup, a report out this week from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration claims 2019 was the second hottest year on record, another data point that seems to back up dire warnings about climate change. The debate in recent years has centered on whether and to what extent such changes are man-made, that is, caused by human activity. The oil and gas industry has been viewed by environmentalists as trying to downplay or undermine climate change research in an effort to stem regulation of their industry. But this week, some eyebrows were raised and headlines were made by remarks from the head of the Texas Oil and Gas Association, Texoga. In a conference call with reporters, Todd Staples, the industry group's president, said that Texoga believes that, quoting here, all emissions contribute to climate change. Joining us now is Todd Staples, president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association. Mr. Staples, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. It's great to be with
you. Good to see you, sir. All right. So this appears to be, and this is certainly the way it's being reported, as an unambiguous acknowledgement of a link between fossil fuel emissions and climate change. Is that right?
I think the term climate change has been hijacked, David. I think it's been used to, unfortunately, introduce climate hysteria or climate confusion. I'm very proud of the work that oil and natural gas does to build a cleaner, stronger energy future. They're the leaders, the champions in low carbon technology and low emissions. And what we do know and what we understand is every energy source is going to have an environmental footprint of some kind. Wind and renewable are great sources and options, and they may be renewable and naturally found, but wind turbines and solar panels are not. And so the conversation that I was hoping to have in the context of the $16.3 billion that's being used to fund our schools and roads is that any energy source is going to have an environmental impact of some sort. So let's have a real conversation about that and recognize that oil and natural gas companies are leading toward a lower emissions future, introducing great technology, and that innovation in technology is the true answer to the future of our energy needs.
Well, no, I think that a lot of folks, especially environmental groups, have said, well, look, the oil and gas industry, as they see it, has been fighting regulation. In fact, back in 2010, you were agriculture commissioner, and you and Governor Perry and other Texas officials fought the federal government over EPA regulations related to climate change, saying that the climate change rules in place were based on faulty science. Would you still agree that the climate change principles that are broadly agreed to are based on faulty science?
I think the term is used in such a way to confuse the public that the sky is falling in. The oil and gas industry and myself are not opposed to regulations per se. We are opposed to politically based regulations and not fact-based regulations. As a lawmaker and as a former regulator, as Commissioner of Agriculture, we know that makes sense to have factually based regulations. A gallon of gas at one corner station should be the equivalent of a gallon of gas at another corner station. And so doing it right is the methodology that we're advocating for.
Now, there are some words that you used that in what you had to say to reporters. For instance, you said, I think Texas is at risk if we don't have a very real, factual-based conversation about our climate, about our environment, and about the progress that needs to be made. Now, to a lot of Texans, that sounds like coming from the head of Texoga. You're saying, look at Hurricane Harvey. Look at all the things that are going on here in Texas. We need to be a part of that conversation.
I think some reporters took a literary license. The question that was posed to me was, is Texas at risk with all the new voters coming in? And that was the question. And so when, you know, if you listen to that entire interview, I believe the very real context reflects that we need everyone engaged on science and facts and not the climate confusion, not the climate hysteria. And that was that whole conversation. We as a country and as a people need to understand and look where our energy future is coming from. I believe that oil and natural gas will be a strong part of that energy future. Our position is that let the consumers choose what source of energy they want. And when we think about electric vehicles, we know they have battery components there. We know that the minerals are mined all over the world to build those batteries. And we know that they're volatile and the transportation of those minerals are volatile. And we know that doing something with those batteries has an environmental footprint as well. So what I don't want there to be any asterisks here today. I want there to be the acknowledgement that we need to look at all energy sources, and the U.S. oil and natural gas industry is very willing to have that conversation. We believe we have a leadership role and a responsibility role to develop solutions for our nation so that we can be strong and secure and independent. And we're going to play that role, and we're happy to answer these types of questions.
Wish we had more time. Todd Staples is president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association. Mr. Staples, good to see you again, sir. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Okay, let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, and find out what Texans are talking about. I have an idea.
Yeah, you get one guess, David. What do you think?
H and E and B?
You would be correct,
first letters?
Sir. My Ed McMahon impersonation there. You are correct, sir.
You are correct.
No, we're talking about the fierce loyalty that Texans have to admittedly great homegrown stores like HEB. A lot of range of opinions. I love this tweet here from Cristela Alonso, the actor and comedian, appeared on the show, friend of the show. Mm-hmm. She says, growing up in San Juan, Texas, our HEB was in Far, Texas, off Business 83, the road there. They had a generic food aisle with items in plain white boxes and black lettering. My family was on food stamps. This aisle was everything to us, and we stayed loyal to it because of that. Very nice story. Of course, HEB not everywhere, as some folks are pointing out. Justin Domlau, he tweets us that he's patiently waiting for the mainline stores to invade Dallas-Fort Worth. I believe they have their what is it? Central Market.
Yeah.
They're sort of upmarket, if you will, brand.
Sort of like
there.
A Whole Foodsy style.
Yeah, Whole Foods style. And we had another commenter shouting out Central Market saying they do Whole Foods better than Whole Foods, which, you know, I think I'd have to concur with. Guardi Gonzalez, he points out that, isn't it weird that there's not a store in El Paso? No HEB in El Paso. Unfortunate there. I think there
really?
Are.
Really? There's no HEB
no
in El Paso?
No HEBs. There's still some. There, I think there's Albertsons and there's Big 8. It's more of the homegrown brand. I always shop at Big 8. The jingle. Shout out to anyone in El Paso who knows the Big 8
yeah,
jingle.
I don't know that one.
It's a good one.
Okay.
It's earworm, obviously. Burrowed okay. Burrowed its way in there.
Uh-huh.
And yes, THX 1138 notes that, yeah, Central Market has a better selection of just about everything. Another commenter noted that you can drink a beer while you're doing your grocery shop at Central Market, which is kind of nice.
Wonder
they
if
have that stuff
dependent upon local ordinances there.
I was speaking of brands,
look at this, a most iconic brand in Texas. There's kind of a bracket going over at Texas Sports Life, I gather.
Yeah, we just saw this on Twitter and we're all like talking about it amongst ourselves. They took a bunch of iconic Texas brands and pitted them against each other like NCAA bracket style.
Yeah.
Really interesting stuff there. Upstart Pluckers Wing Place took out Taco Cabana in the first round. It's going on to the Elite
Eight,
I think.
Like, it looks like we've got State Fair of Texas, Bucky's, Shiner, and Pluckers there. You also have Southwest, Dr. Pepper, Whataburger, and HEB.
Real interesting, and we retweeted that, so you can find that bracket at the Texas Standard Twitter account there. And folks, yeah, chime in. Tell us who you think should make it all
yeah,
the way.
Coming soon to another Texas Standard segment near you, I believe. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the crew, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.